Hello, you're tuned into London's Resonance FM. I'm Jen Kerrison, and you're listening to Group Therapy FM as well. Well, we're not ones to shy away from controversial topics here on Group Therapy. In fact, as you can probably tell, we love them. But I don't know if any topic is as divisive as the one we're covering today. We're going to be talking about ghosts, the haunted, the paranormal, supernatural, and for me, the outright scary. For hundreds of years, people have reported encounters with ghosts and told countless stories about them. Therefore, even if only in the mind, ghosts do have an existence. I'm expecting lots of tweets coming in already from lots of people saying that I'm talking absolute nonsense, but bear with us, please. Now, many of us grew up sharing ghost stories with friends, but as adulthood set in, did you shrug these off as tales of flights of fancy, or has your belief in the other world strengthened? Today we're hearing from a fellow who's sure he's being visited by something at night, and he's not sure that something is a welcome visitor. But first, let's meet today's Ghostbusters, Supernaturalist and Charm Ones. I'm joined by regular guest clinical psychologist, Dr. Jared Caborn. Jared?
Good afternoon, Jen.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Also here in the studio with me is parageographer James Thurgill. Welcome, James.
Hi, Jennifer.
And also, last but certainly not least, it's funny woman comedian Jessica Fostercue. G'day, Jess.
G'day. Hello.
Welcome to the show, guys. Now, let's kick off things by hearing from Harry right now.
There's a ghost in my flat, I'm sure of it. But my flatmates don't believe me. I never used to believe in ghosts. No, actually, I guess I just never thought about them. We live in a cottage in South London built in the 1830s. Apparently it's where the Royal Guards went to live when they were retired off. Anyway, something keeps totally spooking me when I'm there alone. Or at night in my room, I can feel a presence. Sometimes it's right up close to my face, sometimes sitting on my chest. I'm sure I've seen the curtains move of their own accord. Well, not of their own accord. I can't even really believe that I believe this myself, but I'm sure there's something in this house other than just us, and I'm petrified. My flatmates don't know what to think, but they certainly don't believe me, and they really take the piss. I know it sounds weird, but what if this thing starts to be more aggressive than just a presence? Maybe I've been watching too many scary films. I don't know.
Well, has he been watching too many scary films? You're tuned into London's Resonance FM. I'm Jen Kerrison, and we're on Group Therapy right now. Do tweet us your thoughts at Group Therapy FM. You can flick us an email, grouptherapyfm@gmail.com, and we will try to get back to you and get some of them on air if you send us a tweet. Now, remember, we're not here necessarily to provide advice on group therapy, although sometimes I can't help myself and sometimes our guests can't either. We're just here to explore the universal themes and issues that come from our real-life dilemmas. So, Jared Caborn, clinical psychologist. Are ghosts an element of our psyche, or are they something that our minds sort of make up?
I think they can be. I think there might be many reasons why our mind might make up when someone experiences a phenomenon that they kind of label as a ghost. It might be part of our kind of anxiety around death and a hope for continuity and something else after we die. So we might kind of create these ideas in our mind, or it might be perceptual biases that we have about the world. We see something and we don't understand it straight off, so we come up with some explanation that's congruent with our belief system, which might be based on our old memories, stories we've heard, our current mood, the context that we're in. If we go into a haunted house, it's more likely than if we see something falling off a shelf that we're going to say, oh, that's a ghost, rather than that's the wind knocking something off the shelf.
Right. So, okay. So, but you're saying if we go into a haunted house, which sort of suggests that there's a belief
we're
that...
We're primed for haunted. Yeah, we're primed for experiencing something paranormal.
I hope we don't see a ghost in this studio today. I don't want any apparitions while on air. Thank you very much. Jess Fostercue, have you ever seen a ghost?
No. But
and that was good therapy for another week. Thank you very much.
Yeah, what a constructive answer. My partner, my boyfriend, thinks there's a ghost in our flat. He says he sees shadows out the corner of his eyes and stuff like that. And I think it's a mixture of him trying to scare me to the point where he would have a flat to himself again. And also trying to make himself feel better about the fact that I move a lot of his stuff and throw a lot of it away. But the other day, I think having this instilled in me and being quite susceptible to suggestion, I'm a big Darren Brown fan and all that sort of stuff, and I'm aware of what has been building up. I sat alone in my flat in the kitchen and I looked out into the corridor and I thought, oh, there's our cat. And then I realised we don't have a cat. dun, dun, and I'd dun. Seen a cat ghost. But more likely is that I really want a cat and we're not allowed one. So I think it was a hopeful ghost. Also, I'd just been looking out of a bright window and then just looked into a dark tunnel of a... I think science might disprove that it was a cat ghost.
Right. Okay, well, we're going to talk a little bit about science's involvement in ghosts or the haunted or the paranormal in a moment. But, James Thurgill, you're a parageographer. Talk to me firstly about how you got into becoming a parageographer.
Well, firstly, I made up the term parageographer to make me seem somehow more substantial in my career.
Well, it's working already.
But yeah, I mean, there seemed to be sort of around the early part of sort of the 2000s, an academic movement, at least within geography, looking at sort of the spectral, at ghosts, and at the way sort of places might be haunted. And sort of all of the work that was involved with this tend to deal with things like trauma and loss, and really using ghosts as a kind of figurative mechanism or a metaphor to talk about the things that aren't there in place, but not really dealing with hauntings. Now, the work that I've been doing sort of over the past 4 or 5 years is looking more at places that are perceived or described as being haunted, but in this more traditional sense, i.e. the kind of spooks that are hanging around there, and looking at the people that are engaging with them and the ways, sort of the practices that they're using to kind of involve themselves in these places.
So tell me, James, is what Harry is seeing or feeling, is this likely to be a ghost?
I mean, I don't wish to be dismissive, but no, probably not.
Right.
If I'm honest.
We've got Jess, no, I've never seen a ghost. James, no, it's not a ghost. I hope we've picked the right topic today.
I think for the majority of cases, and you know, this is for sake of generalising here, there's a particular context in which a ghost may pop up or occur or presence. And I mean, we sort of have this stereotypical notion of the haunted house anyway. And perhaps this is kind of, if we listen to what Harry's saying here, it starts with the old building. We've already got the context of it being built in the 1830s. Why is that important? Are we sort of, you know, do ghosts have to come from particular periods? Perhaps Jared can talk about this more, but there was a particular sort of psychology in the Victorian period where ghosts and mediums, the kind of the psychic, became far more kind of predominant in mainstream culture.
Okay, well, you're listening to London's Resonance FM. I'm Jen Kerrison, and we're here today with my guests Jessica Fostercue, James Thurgill, and Jared Caborn, and we're talking about all things scary to me. Not scary to some at all if you don't believe in ghosts. James, it sounds like you're exploring sort of the way that people are engaging with ghosts in these places. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I'm curious, does the presence of a ghost make a place haunted? What is a haunted place, first off? And does it take a ghost to make a place haunted?
I think, I mean, for me, the idea of a haunted place, I guess I'd relate back to the geographer John Wiley's text, where he sort of described all places, or haunting as a prerequisite for place, is to kind of decide properly. And I think, you know, looking at hauntings and at ghosts, I don't think that we can sort of really look at place in a way where we don't have this kind of this context whereby we can kind of bring ghosts or histories back into being. So the fact that it's this particular case is looking at a place built in the 1830s, and we're talking about the Royal Guards. We've already got people that are there, and it kind of allows this kind of past to permeate our presence.
But created there by Harry. I mean, it's Harry's story that, you're right, he chose to bring into this dilemma that these places has a history. So, Jared,
setting up the context.
How important is this history or this context in people's belief of these things?
Like I was saying before, kind of it primes him. All of a sudden he has a narrative. It's a bit like, you know, I often hear sort of at Hampton Court Palace, and therefore when guests go to visit Hampton Court Palace, you're kind of looking out, will I see the ghost of a lady who walks down the corridor or something? So you're looking out for a lady walking down a corridor. So therefore, if you see someone walking down a corridor, you're primed already to think, is that a ghost?
It's already been planted in your mind, hasn't it?
And I
I worked for years, in scare attractions. I was a trained zombie. That's what I did with my degree. and I've worked in all sorts, I won't name them, but all sorts all over London. And I worked in one that was built in a plague pit. That there it was, it had been a nightclub, it had been all sorts of things, and then they built this horrific scare attraction in it, and I was a, you know, you're all in there and all covered in prosthetic kind of makeup and stuff like that, and there's this machinery, and then the smells are horrible, and I think without doubt I've worked in, that's probably the third or fourth one I've worked in, and all of the others were constructed, and this one I think it won all sorts of awards because it genuinely was in somewhere where people have already got all of this associative stuff. And it's all to do with... But I mean, perhaps that's why I'm that bit more cynical now, having worked in all of these places.
But you still
see cats. It desensitised you because you... I suppose you have to kind of... You know, your eyes adjust to the dark, as it were, and you know that these are all sound effects and all that sort of stuff. And in this one that I worked in, they did an episode of Most Haunted. And... You know, you can watch it on television and they'll be listening to ghosts. That was us upstairs making ghost noises into the vents, into the air vents. And it got onto telly, you know, and oh, it was just amazing. All this kind of, you know, you build up all this suspense, and one of the producers got inside a coffin that was in there and they put the lid on it without having asked anybody that worked there or knew anything about the building, and it was airtight. And
did the producer make it out alive?
Yeah, they did.
Wow.
But it was the whole thing was just shambolic. And I don't I think if you can associate all these things, smell, noise, lights, and again, I think it's really important that he's learnt this history about the house. Also, I mean, lucky chap living in this probably must be a listed building.
But it is, I think, the context. Yeah. The context is
put
important.
Put up with the ghost, you've got a great house.
You've got a gorgeous house. It sounds like
I think that context is important. It's making me think actually there was another programme a bit like Most Haunted called Haunted Homes. And the difference about that show was that they had a psychologist who was the skeptic that went in. And I remember him talking on a show after it and talking about how actually when they were filming kind of the ghost investigation, he wasn't really allowed to be with the people in the house. He was watching from a remote camera outside, because if he was in the room being the skeptic and they were talking about, can you hear that noise? Then he would just say, well, that's your central heating coming on. It kind of just, it ruined the atmosphere. And they said, actually, it doesn't work. It doesn't allow that atmosphere, that context to be built as a haunted arena.
So how important is a collective belief in suggesting that something is haunted? I guess this collected narrative, James, your thoughts on...
Twofold answer, I guess, would be that, A, it's paramount, depending on the type of kind
of... So a place can't be haunted unless we believe it's haunted?
I think so. That would be... But at the same time, I mean, I think if we're relating back to sort of larger, more well-known places as being haunted, say, Hampton Court Palace, that relies on a kind of a lineage, at least, of kind of narratives being told to kind of keep the ghost at least sort of relevant.
But a ghost has got to start somewhere, right? You know, in 100 years, 150 years, there could be the ghost of Jessica Foster Kew's cat that still roams around the house.
It's an imaginary cat, you know, so that would be pretty impressive.
By then, Jessica Foster Kew will have her own blue badge on this, a blue plaque on this house, and it will be the place where Jessica Foster Kew first saw Jessica Foster Kew's cat. You know, how does this idea of something being haunted start for us then to have a collective belief around it, James?
I think in part it's probably to do with a coping mechanism. And perhaps there is there's a psychology behind this, but in general we're sort of always kind of propelling forward if we're lucky enough to live. We sort of carry on going into the future. But we've got no way of really sort of dealing with the history that lays behind us. And I think at some point, you know, with this layers up, and you know, I think we're sort of out wanting to sort of explain away the ghost as being mere fantasy. I think it sort of acts as a nice conduit in which to kind of understand our place in the world and the things that are around us. So an old cottage in London, 1830s, if something creaks, then it's quite nice to think that actually stuff that happened before hasn't just been forgotten, but perhaps it's still there and we can still sort of live with it and beside it. And then it also kind of gives a legacy to ourselves. We don't have to see an end point. There's something that we can perhaps go on. So
we'd like to be part of something bigger.
It sounds very much to me, though, James, that this is coming from someone, from you, and it sounds to me like you're not afraid of ghosts or you're not afraid of the haunted. For me, if I'm in an 1830s house and I hear something that goes creak, it's certainly not comforting to think, oh, well, that's just, you know, one of the thousands of people that have lived in this house and died and been tortured and hanged or whatever before me. There's no comfort in that at all. Jared, I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with that. Jared, why are people emotionally drawn to this idea of haunted places? Why do you think people want to go to Hampden Court Palace to perhaps see this woman floating down the corridor? I can't think of anything worse.
Well, I think you've hit it on the nail on the head there, that it's individual differences. Some people will really be fascinated and want to kind of enjoy that feeling of being scared in a safe environment. That's, you know, they're not kind of putting themselves in a situation with, you know, potential serial killer. It's a ghost, and it's kind of this quite exciting feeling of being scared. But other people, like yourself, actually, it terrifies you. So therefore, you probably wouldn't go to Hampden Court Palace. Although,
well, I would have. I didn't know it was haunted until today. I won't be going back there. I've been there.
But you might also be primed for different reasons, kind of a fear priming, kind of looking out for it, becoming quite hyper-vigilant to things, to kind of your threat system will be up, kind of making sure that you're safe against this ghost. And actually what we do know is that there is probably some personality, kind of underlying characteristics of people that are more primed to be susceptible, shall we say, to suggestion or to seeing or witnessing paranormal phenomena.
Well, on that note, Jess, you mentioned the idea of science possibly discrediting your theory of the ghost cat before. I would think that more and more people are becoming sort of attuned to a world that is beyond just the world, this empirical world that we can see and touch and feel. More of us are going to see clairvoyance. More of us are becoming interested in religions that have some sort of spirit guides and whatnot.
Oh, I think we've always, as far as history goes back, been interested in being part of something bigger than ourselves, you said. And I think that's part of the draw. But I also think even more, especially from having worked in lots of scare attractions, and they're proliferating now. And it's not just teenagers. I think we do enjoy being scared. Yep, and I think sometimes that's a subconscious thing. And there's all sorts of other emotions. There's so many reasons for that. I mean, it's life-affirming fear. So, you know, probably similar reason that people bungee jump and do extreme sports. It's adrenaline. Yeah. And also it can be hilarious if you're with a group of friends and one of them is scared.
It's a collective.
And even, it is a safe environment. But, the proliferation of sort of violence and horror in the things that we watch and the things that we read, it is exciting. And I think, if you go somewhere in a group or if you watch a scary film in a group and one person is scared, that's hilarious to the other people. So it's entertaining for yourself and for others on so many different levels. I think we're drawn to it on that sort of slightly masochistic level as well.
I went to see that horrible film Paranormal Activity when I was back in Australia a few years ago. I went with my brother and my sister, and we were sitting in the cinema, and I walked in being all tough, this isn't going to scare me. And at one point, my brother must have just shifted in his seat and his jumper brushed against my arm. And I nearly wet myself. And I screamed so loudly that I think probably 50% of the audience nearly wet themselves as well.
But it's an experience of art in a sense that way. We enjoy the experience of being manipulated because we're impressed by it, you know, as well. I mean, and it is that I on the occasion where I can be made to feel really scared. I've been made to feel something. I'm impressed.
The power of suggestion, you know, that you're more susceptible. Jen, it seems that you're quite a susceptible person to that film, the power of suggestion that you could also experience Paranormal Activity, your brother's sleeve brushing your arm.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just having these conversations now, the hairs on the back of my head.
I shuddered when you said that about the jumper.
And I'm just, you know, this idea that even just talking about ghosts can sometimes be enough to scare people. When I mentioned to our clinical psychologist, Jared Caborn, a few weeks ago that we were going to be doing a program that he was going to be on and it was going to be covering this subject, Jared actually said to me, Jen, I don't know whether did say this, did you?
Sometimes I can give myself goosebumps if I think about something enough. Then you can create you can create that response, which I think just shows the power of the mind in these situations. That if I close my eyes now and actually thought of a ghost or walking through Hampden Court Palace on my own, I could potentially get myself to kind of get goosebumps, which I think is an amazing, not a skill, but an amazing thing the mind can do.
Why does this happen, James Thurgill?
Thanks for that. I think, you know, being a geographer, for me it all really comes down to place and our understanding of place and how we exist within it. So there was some work done. I can't even give you a date.
This is
a long, long time ago, by philosopher Albertus Magnus. And he sort of really came up with a theory that all memories are located in places. We can't think of something or being doing something, a feeling, an emotion, without locating it somewhere. So in that sense, you know, I'd sort of tie that maybe to the thing I was saying about John Wiley, where all places are kind of haunted in this sense, that there's always something there, whether it's our memory or it's someone else's. And I think just our general way of kind of experiencing somewhere is by kind of looking at what's present and also what's absent. So even if we're looking at smells, you can walk into a room having been somewhere where someone's been smoking. And particularly I find this with cigar smoke. If you've been somewhere, you can smell the cigar smoke. It's heavy, it's thick, it stays there. And that changes your experience of that room. Now, whether you want to then interpret that as being, you know, it's, am I smelling the cigar smoke of a, it could be sort of, you know, a snug from the Victorian era or something, if you happen to be in an old building, and it's sort of the ghosts of that period trying to make contact or reconnect with me. You know, that depends on the individual, but I think a lot of the time it's about us engaging with the things that, like, the sort of the materiality and the immateriality of place to try and build an experience of the now.
I want to talk now about Harry's flatmates that don't believe him. It strikes me that when it comes to the paranormal or the supernatural, whatever we want to call it, most of us are filled with contradictions. So even the greatest of skeptics may have some spiritual element to them, or perhaps someone who will outright say they don't believe in ghosts, and yet they'll go and see a clairvoyant. Aren't all of these sorts of things cut from the same cloth? If you believe in burning an incense stick or praying, or, you know, giving a thought to a long lost loved one, shouldn't you also believe in ghosts, Jess?
I think to an extent. I think with regards to Harry's flatmates, it's humour and ridicule is a standard defence mechanism. Certainly, trite coming from a comedian, but it's it really is. I think if you there may be fear in that, you know, they might not want to accept it as true. And I think if they, personally, in my opinion, anyone who's an absolute definite opinion on something that you can't possibly know, absolutely definitely does or doesn't exist, is, you know, I mean, is this blood? I think it's a possibility that ghosts exist. It's a possibility that there's a God. But, you know, it comes down to all these things. And I think the group mentality of all the people around, he could easily argue that it's their fear that means they're masking it by taking the mickey out of him for believing it. You know, I think that could well be one of the reasons.
James Thurgill, why do we find the paranormal so hard to believe in? Is science winning? Has science taught us to believe that if there's no empirical data, then it doesn't exist?
I think, to be honest, when it comes to the paranormal, science is far less involved than it is with something like, say, religion. If perhaps we're looking at, say, take the atheist movement as an example, there seems to be a big movement within science to make people recognize kind of the beauty and the magic of science itself, of the way things work. And of course, sort of grand narratives that are involved within religion and spirituality tend to try and undo that magic. They sort of explain it away almost with, you know, I don't want to be too controversial. But in the same way that
it's community radio, James. If you can't do it here, where can you do it?
Of course. But sort of explaining away things in the same way that perhaps sort of fairy tales do to children. Not that I want to draw comparisons between the two. But I think when we're talking about the paranormal, particularly, sort of, I worked quite closely with the Ghost Club for a number of years, going on investigations. And
Just explain briefly what the Ghost Club is.
The Ghost Club is the oldest kind of paranormal investigation group in the world, and sort of founding members were Charles Dickens and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, so well before Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. probably got more popular afterwards. People looking for Slimer.
Sure.
But I mean, there's sort of having gone on these investigations, there's a great deal of science that's involved with it, and I think because it's not really trying to explain away anything as a sort of, I don't know, in a kind of fairy tale, or actually as a mysticism, it really tries to get to grips with what is going on. So, is there a science behind people coming back from the dead that's not merely spiritual, but something that we can kind of tangibly engage with and record and document? And if so, kind of what are the ramifications of these? And I think that's far more important for kind of parapsychologists and also just kind of amateur ghost hunters than, I don't know, just, yeah, trying to engage with something a bit spooky.
Jared, why, when it comes to engaging with things a bit spooky, for me, it terrifies me. Some people, it brings some sort of comfort to. Can you explain how we would get comfort from thinking there might be a ghost in our house?
I think part of all of us probably have some anxiety or some thoughts around death and our own mortality. And therefore, if you can have an interest in ghosts and spirits, then it might, for some people, provide that comfort that there isn't just the end. There's this kind of need for continuity. And if you can have a belief and see apparitions of loved ones that have passed on or people, then it gives you that comfort that, okay, it's okay. Kind of our death, which is kind of our ultimate fear, in a sense, it doesn't need to be feared as much.
Jared, how do we distinguish between an apparition and a hallucination?
That's difficult. I suppose that's where kind of I've been thinking.
How do you know you're not crazy,
this.
Basically?
Yeah, that's what I've been thinking throughout kind of listening to this, thinking, you know, we also have to be aware that some people do see things and hear things, and actually that's more of a symptom of a kind of a mental health difficulty, such as psychosis. Not saying that this gentleman here has psychosis, and I think that's where you have to really kind of explore quite carefully the difference between an illusion, so seeing something and misinterpreting it because you are primed in some way, for example, or an hallucination, so having a perceptual experience of something which isn't there, which comes from within, so kind of this top-down process, and so something from within kind of then seeing it in the external world, if that makes sense. Kind of, I'm trying to do it in a very short kind of spiel, but...
Well, there can be errors in our perception of things as well, though, can't there?
So if you are then struggling or kind of experiencing the psychosis, that will then go on to probably have an impact on how you then perceive other events, which then kind of maintain the difficulties.
So then could seeing a ghost in real life that you think is a hallucination in fact kickstart some sort of psychosis?
Again, I suppose my thoughts would always be it's not always the experiences that we have that distress us, it's our appraisal. So if I see something, I might just think, oh, that's a ghost, that's fine, that'll probably never happen again. If I think, oh my God, I'm losing my mind, actually, I don't know how to manage this, why is this coming to me? I'm special in some way, it's coming to kind of get me, then I might become more distressed and preoccupied with it.
I think like you were saying, Jared, about you do get all sorts of people that see loved ones after they've passed away, and I think it's almost a comfort thing. Also, I think that's why I saw a cat, because I really want a cat. And maybe Harry feels vulnerable and he really wants a royal guard.
That's a lovely projection, that would be.
I really want things all the time.
Have you not ever seen any ghost cheese?
I've never seen any ghost cheese, and I've never seen a ghost pile of £1 million either, Jess. So granted, you may want your cat, but it's also, I guess, possibly feasible that it was just your neighbour's cat that had come in to meet the new neighbours.
I mean, it's just impossible that a cat could have got into a top floor flat in that situation. But, I mean, what's the difference? I have visualised £1 million. What's the difference between a mirage and a ghost, you know, sometimes?
Well, what's the difference also between something that is there and something that isn't there? It's our belief that it's there.
Yeah.
But if you've tried to believe, like I have many, many times before, that you have £1 million. It doesn't work when you get to the cash point, does it, though? And it just keeps telling you once again that it's declined. Well, look, I think we're going far too into the territory of my money woes, so we might close the show right there. I would like to thank my guests very much for joining us. Jessica Foster-Kew, you have a gig coming up. It's a while away, but it's worth the wait. On the 27th of May, your Edinburgh preview show.
Yes.
Called Moving.
Yeah.
Will it involve the cat, Jess?
It may be well.
You'll have to go along to find out. It's only £3 and you're doing that with the wonderful comic Tony Law. Yeah. James Thurgill, thank you very much for being on the show today. And as always, Jared Caborn, we will see you again next week,
Cheers.
Next week. Next week, we're exploring passivity. Do you pull your own strings or let others boss you around? And how do we tap into our power centre? Group Therapy has been co-produced by the lovely Sophie Lording. Thanks so much for tuning in. Bye-bye.